Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Midland Reporter Telegram, Saturday, July 17th, 2021. Midland unemployment rises to 6.7%. Displaced school contract workers push state jobless numbers higher. By Mella McEwen. Rising summer temperatures send unemployment rising across the state in June, according to data released Friday by the Texas Workforce Commission. The commission said June unemployment in its Midland Metropolitan Statistical Area, MSA, which includes Midland and Martin counties, rose to 6.7% from 6.2% in May. Still, the rate is far below the 12% Midland reported last June. "We all get seasonal upticks," said Willie Taylor, chief executive officer of the Commission's Workforce Solutions Permian Basin office, referring to increases seen in all 26 of the Commission's MSAs. Increases range from a half point to a full point in College Station, Bryan, Laredo, and McAllen, Edinburgh, Mission. Odessa saw its unemployment rate rise to 9.7% from 9.1% in May. Odessa's rate in June 2020 was 15.7%. Speaking with the Reporter Telegram by telephone, Taylor said contract workers displaced by the end of the school year for the summer added to unemployment in June. That likely helped the number of unemployed Midlanders rise by 500 to 6,619 from 6,118 in May. The number of unemployed Midlanders in June 2020 was 11,816. Midland's civilian labor force rose by about 700 to 98,630, just 227 below the 98,857 reported last June, and from the more than 100,000 recorded pre-pandemic. "We have a ways to go before we're back over 100,000, observed Taylor, who added he is still pleased to see Midland and Odessa retain so much of their workforces during the downturn. One concern he hears from his board members is the shortage of workers and the needs to bring workers in, he said. He said he continues to encourage the unemployed to return to the workforce and see a willingness by out-of-work residents to do so. Training facilities at the local colleges see high demand, he said, for everything from hospitality to medical to education, as well as skilled positions in automotive, diesel, and plumbing, to name a few. His office continues to hold job fairs virtually every couple of weeks. A job fair aimed at teens is scheduled for the fall. People seem to be ready to go back to work, Taylor said, but a barrier would be a shortage of childcare. I can't yet tell how much of an impact childcare will have on moms wanting to go back to work, Taylor said. We do have a lot of childcare dollars available for those needing help. He is also seeing a number of residents take the opportunity to become entrepreneurs rather than going to work for a company. We're seeing a lot of mobile car washes, mobile oil changes, a lot of home repair businesses, he said. If you drive around Midland, you see now hiring signs, Taylor added. If you want to go to work, you can go to work. Midland added 900 jobs from May to June for a total of 96,900 non-farm positions. The leisure and hospitality sector led with 500 new jobs, followed closely by the region's dominant mining, logging, and construction sector with 400 new jobs. The trade, transportation, and utility sector, and other services sector each added 100 jobs. Education and health services and the government sector each lost 100 jobs. From June 2020 to June 2021, Midland has added 5,100 jobs, led by mining, logging, and construction, with the addition of 2,400 jobs. The leisure and hospitality sector added 1,600 jobs, and trade, transportation, and utilities 800 jobs. The government sector added 700 jobs, while the information sector and financial activity sector each added 100 jobs. The professional and business service sector has lost 500 jobs over the last 12 months, and the manufacturing sector 100 jobs. Statewide, the unemployment rate dipped to 6.5% from 6.6% in May. The state added 55,800 jobs over the month, marking gains in 13 of the last 14 months. Texas has added 654,200 jobs since June 2020. Amarillo reported the lowest unemployment in the state at 4.5%, followed by Austin, Round Rock at 4.8%, and Sherman-Denison at 5.3%. The highest was McAllen-Edinburgh Mission at 10.8%. Midland Reporter-Telegram, Saturday, July 17th, 2021. Commentary: kindness is key for life after COVID. Words matter. Put focus on integrity as Midland grows, heals. Jonna Smoot, community advocate. Objects in the rearview mirror may appear closer than they are. I was honored to be asked my opinion of what my priority for our community in a post-COVID Midland is. I found that putting my pen to paper and then those thoughts into a type end product for all to see took me longer than I anticipated, which made me a little angry at, or unkind in thought to, myself. The phrase, objects in the rearview mirror may appear closer than they are, has never been truer. And the phrase is not just from a Meatloaf song about hope, growing up, and loss. After well over a year's time, and millions of COVID-19-related deaths globally, I don't have to look back to know that COVID's impact will likely always loom large in everyone's rearview mirror. I also know that I have to be looking forward in order to see my rearview mirror, and I don't have to look back to know that I was one of the extremely lucky ones during COVID. Working in the banking industry, my job was considered essential, and because I have a private office, I was allowed to conduct my day-to-day work at my actual place of business. I was extremely blessed that my 80-year-old parents remained healthy and at home in the company of their beloved English bulldog, Max. Of my 5 brothers and sisters, their respective spouses, and their children, 20 in total, each remained healthy, employed, and part of their communities. My heart goes out to so many others who are not so fortunate in so many ways. COVID was not something for which anyone could have planned, and its wide array of disastrous effects will not soon be forgotten. At the age of 51, I have lived long enough to see many things, some wonderful, and some, like the effects of COVID, terrible. And I know that there is still so much for me to do, give, see, and experience. With that in mind, putting my pen to paper and my thoughts in typed form took on the focus of this article. While we are so much more than the sum of our parts, what we think, say, do, the one thought that kept coming back to me while writing this is words matter. For the umpteenth time in a day, I saw the phrase be kind, and this time I sat down to think about what those words really mean. Did they mean that I should tip my service providers extra generously, or that I need to go to a drive-thru lane and pay for the order or orders behind me? Did they mean that I should hug a stranger? Looking to the internet, I found that 3 things in human life are important. The first is to be kind, the second is to be kind, and the third is to be kind. And while I was sitting at my kitchen counter typing this, I spied a wedding invite that directed me to kindly reply. There's those words again, be kind. So I reflect upon this COVID-19 impacted last 18 months, and I think, what does being kind really mean? I think it means that each of us has a personal responsibility to each other. We are to act with integrity on all things. We are to use our words, deeds, and actions wisely, and not at the expense of others. The COVID-19 pandemic put people at a distance, and that distance was most often bridged via digital divide. Facebook and other social media outlets saw an uptick in usage during the pandemic, and there were those who used social media as their very own whipping post. They trolled the internet, perusing, patrolling, and sometimes pejoratively used it to make whatever point they felt the world should see. Regardless of whether or not the commentary was true, and least of all regardless of whether or not the commentary was kind, people were angry and defeated during the pandemic, and they were going to make sure we all knew it. As early as May of 2020, the Centers for Disease Control, one of the pandemic's global go-to websites, reported that social media usage surged as much as 61%. A March 1st article by Ronnie Mola at Vox.com details that while social media allowed some to feel better connected, others felt insanely guilty and anxious due to the type of post in their feeds. The article goes on to state that the pandemic has normalized the negative side of life. If all we ever focus on is the negative side of life, then all we will see and experience is negativity. My focus has been and will remain on the positive side. During these past 18 months, several of my friendships became stronger. I became even more involved with charitable organizations, and I watched Midland begin to grow and thrive again. This year, from my front yard, I watched as new homes in my neighborhood continued to be built. A new car wash arrived, while another new car wash was begun, and a medical building all began to take shape and become a new part of my daily viewing existence. I love seeing the economic growth just in my immediate neighborhood, and recognized it for all that it can do for Midland now and in the future. Being kind happens in so many ways, and is a matter of degrees whose impact can be exponential. Having the last word can be so satisfactory to so many. Unfortunately, that last word is not always something said with a kind spirit. To the end, I suggest that we all try to have the last word in each conversation, be it in person or electronically. Let's all try to make that last word something which leaves us, our neighbors, and Midland as a whole in a better place in which to try and live our best lives and move our community forward. When I look back in my rearview mirror, I want to do so with a smile and a sense that I had a little part in helping bring Midland to its brightest days.
Hello, this is Michael, continuing to read from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Saturday, July 17th. Chevron partnership with WTFB rolls out Produce Pod by J.C. Lewis. The West Texas Food Bank, WTFB, announced the Produce Pod to help underserved areas and presented by Chevron. The Produce Pod project was put on hold due to the pandemic, but now the WTFB and Chevron are rolling it out to underserved rural areas in the 19-county service area of the food bank, according to a press release. The WTFB's collaboration with Chevron also includes the community kitchen, which pre-COVID was serving about 1,500 children through the Kids Cafe and summer feeding programs. At the beginning of the pandemic, the feeding programs could not operate due to safety concerns, but the kitchen didn't cease operations. The Chevron Community Kitchen made hot meals for 10 weeks. The cooks not only fed the WTFB staff, but also the Texas State Troopers who came by to help with the pantry and the National Guard. Over that 10-week period, the Chevron Community Kitchen served more than 50 people a day, totaling 2,500 meals, according to the press release. The Produce Pod will launch at the Martin County Food Pantry on Monday.
Midland Reporter Telegram, Saturday, July 17th, 2021. Commentary: kindness is key for life after COVID. Words matter. Put focus on integrity as Midland grows, heals. Jonas Moot, community advocate. Objects in the rearview mirror may appear closer than they are. I was honored to be asked my opinion of what my priority for our community in a post-COVID Midland is. I found that putting my pen to paper and then those thoughts into a type end product for all to see took me longer than I anticipated, which made me a little angry at, or unkind in thought to, myself. The phrase, objects in the rearview mirror may appear closer than they are, has never been truer. And the phrase is not just from a Meatloaf song about hope, growing up, and loss. After well over a year's time, and millions of COVID-19-related deaths globally, I don't have to look back to know that COVID's impact will likely always loom large in everyone's rearview mirror. I also know that I have to be looking forward in order to see my rearview mirror, and I don't have to look back to know that I was one of the extremely lucky ones during COVID. Working in the banking industry, my job was considered essential, and because I have a private office, I was allowed to conduct my day-to-day work at my actual place of business. I was extremely blessed that my 80-year-old parents remained healthy and at home in the company of their beloved English bulldog, Max. Of my 5 brothers and sisters, their respective spouses, and their children, 20 in total, Each remained healthy, employed, and part of their communities. My heart goes out to so many others who are not so fortunate in so many ways. COVID was not something for which anyone could have planned, and its wide array of disastrous effects will not soon be forgotten. At the age of 51, I have lived long enough to see many things, some wonderful, and some, like the effects of COVID, terrible. And I know that there is still so much for me to do, give, see, and experience. With that in mind, putting my pen to paper and my thoughts in typed form took on the focus of this article. While we are so much more than the sum of our parts, what we think, say, do, the one thought that kept coming back to me while writing this is words matter. For the umpteenth time in a day, I saw the phrase, be kind, and this time I sat down to think about what those words really mean. Did they mean that I should tip my service providers extra generously, or that I need to go to a drive-thru lane and pay for the order or orders behind me? Did they mean that I should hug a stranger? Looking to the internet, I found that three things in human life are important. The first is to be kind, the second is to be kind, and the third is to be kind. And while I was sitting at my kitchen counter typing this, I spied a wedding invite that directed me to kindly reply. There's those words again, be kind. So I reflect upon this COVID-19 impacted last 18 months, and I think, what does being kind really mean? I think it means that each of us has a personal responsibility to each other. We are to act with integrity on all things. We are to use our words, deeds, and actions wisely and not at the expense of others. The COVID-19 pandemic put people at a distance, and that distance was most often bridged via digital divide. Facebook and other social media outlets saw an uptick in usage during the pandemic, and there were those who used social media as their very own whipping post. They trolled the internet, perusing, patrolling, and sometimes pejoratively used it to make whatever point they felt the world should see. Regardless of whether or not the commentary was true, and least of all regardless of whether or not the commentary was kind. People were angry and defeated during the pandemic, and they were going to make sure we all knew it. As early as May of 2020, the Centers for Disease Control, one of the pandemic's global go-to websites, reported that social media usage surged as much as 61%. A March 1st article by Ronnie Mola at Vox.com details that while social media allowed some to feel better connected, others felt insanely guilty and anxious due to the type of post in their feeds. The article goes on to state that the pandemic has normalized the negative side of life. If all we ever focus on is the negative side of life, then all we will see and experience is negativity. My focus has been and will remain on the positive side. During these past 18 months, several of my friendships became stronger. I became even more involved with charitable organizations, and I watched Midland begin to grow and thrive again. This year, from my front yard, I watched as new homes in my neighborhood continued to be built. A new car wash arrived, while another new car wash was begun, and a medical building all began to take shape, become a new part of my daily viewing existence. I love seeing the economic growth just in my immediate neighborhood, and recognized it for all that it can do for Midland now and in the future. Being kind happens in so many ways, and is a matter of degrees whose impact can be exponential. Having the last word can be so satisfactory to so many. Unfortunately, that last word is not always something said with a kind spirit. To the end, I suggest that we all try to have the last word in each conversation, be it in person or electronically. Let's all try to make that last word something which leaves us, our neighbors, and Midland as a whole in a better place in which to try and live our best lives and move our community forward. When I look back in my rearview mirror, I want to do so with a smile and a sense that I had a little part in helping bring Midland to its brightest days.
Hello, this is Cindy reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram for Saturday, July 17th. Filing period for City Council begins Monday. Beginning Monday, those interested in serving for the next 3 years on the Midland City Council can file to put their respective names on the November 2nd ballot. The seats on the ballot are District 1, generally North Midland, District 2, generally East and South Midland, and 2 at-large positions elected citywide. Those currently serving are Scott Duffer, District 1, John Norman, District 2, and Spencer Robnett, and Michael Trost at large. Only Dufford has stated publicly that he intends to run. The Midland City Secretary's Office reports that the filing period will take place from July 19th to August 16th. There will be a packed race for the at-large seats, even before Robnett or Trost declare their respective intentions. A line is already forming to compete. The City of Midland allowed voters to pick their 2 favorites for at-large, and the top 2 vote-getters win seats. Plurality, not a majority, is needed for victory in all races. Those having announced for the at-large race are Ross Schumann, Dan Corrales, and Robin Poole. Dustin Johnson is expected to be the 4th, as he has scheduled an event to announce on Monday. A story will appear in the Reporter-Telegram later in the week. Should those 4 and the 2 current at-large council members run, that would make 6 candidates, one of the larger fields for a city race in recent memory. Following the filing period, the Reporter-Telegram will contact those who have filed to offer questions for opinion articles and set up candidate forums ahead of Election Day. The Midland County Elections Office reports that 2 weeks of early voting will begin October 18th. The county reports that voters must be registered to vote 30 days before the election. The deadline to register to vote is October 4th. The deadline to submit an application for ballot by mail is October 22nd. To see the map of city council districts, go to midlandtexas.gov/238/mayor-city-council.
Drilling activity continues recovery. By Mella McEwen. Drilling activity continues a steady rise as the rig count recovers from last year's sharp decline. Oilfield services firm Baker Hughes and data analytics firm Enverus reported the U.S. rig count rose 5 to 484 this week. The 2 companies reported there are 231 more rigs at work than the 253 at work last July. There were 380 rigs seeking crude, up 2, and 200 more than the 180 drilling for oil last year. There were 104 rigs drilling for natural gas, up 3 for the week, and up by 33 from the 71 drilling for natural gas a year ago. Texas reported 222 rigs at work statewide, down 2 for the week. That's 118 rigs more than the 104 at work last year. Texas was the only producing state to report a decline for the week. New Mexico was unchanged at 75 rigs, while Alaska, Louisiana, Oklahoma, and Wyoming each reported gains to their rig counts. The Permian Basin had 238 rigs drilling throughout the region, up 1 for the week. There are 114 more rigs active in the Permian than the 124 reported last year. Lee County, New Mexico, remains the most active county in the Permian with 45 rigs, down 2 for the week. Midland County follows with 34 rigs, down 4 for the week, and the steepest drop among Permian Basin counties. Eddy County, New Mexico, had 29 rigs, up 2 for the week. Reeves County was close behind with 28 rigs, up 2. Martin County reported 21 rigs, up 3 for the week, and the biggest gain among Permian Basin counties. Loving County had 15 rigs active within county lines, down 3. Howard County reported 13 rigs, unchanged for the week, and Upton County had 12 rigs, down 1. Borden County saw renewed activity with 1 active rig, while Yoakum County saw no activity for the week with the loss of its 1 rig. According to Enverus Rig Analytics, which has a different timeline and criteria than Baker Hughes, the U.S. rig count fell by 2 rigs in the last week to a total of 536 as of July 14th. The count is up 6% month over month and up 93% year over year. The most notable change in the week was in the Permian, where active rigs dropped by 6 to 216. In the last month, the Gulf Coast has seen a 10-rig increase to 64, and the Anadarko Basin has added 9 to reach 40. Natural gas has been making a run, with Henry Hub up nearly 40% since the end of March. The four-month contract settled at $3.61 per MMBTU on July 14th, which is more than double the price a year ago. The recovery over the last year has fueled increased drilling in the Arkansas, Louisiana, Texas region, primarily driven by the Haynesville. As of July 14th, the rig count in the region is up 70% year over year and has remained flat in the last month at 56. The most active operators are Aethon Energy, 10 rigs, Comstock Resources, 7, the Indigo Natural Resources, 6, each running 3 more rigs than a year ago. Pipeline-constrained Appalachia has seen a smaller year-over-year increase of 21% to 40 rigs currently. The most active operator in that basin is Southwestern Energy, 4 rigs, followed by Ascent Resources, Utica, Chesapeake Energy, EQT Corporation, Seneca Resources, and Tug Hill Operating, each running 3 rigs. COVID-19 cases rise again, undercutting prices for oil, by Mella McEwen. Resurgent oil prices ran into the year-long roadblock that is the COVID-19 pandemic this week, as a resurgence in COVID-19 cases undercut optimism about oil demand. Bloomberg reported prices posted the largest decline since March amid rising cases, though prices held above the $71 level. West Texas Intermediate on the New York Mercantile Exchange fell 3 of the last 5 trading days, including a $2.12 drop Wednesday, followed by a $1.48 decline Thursday. Prices eked out a 16-cent gain Friday to close at $71.81 per barrel, down from $74.10 at Monday's close, and a 3.7% drop for the week. The posted price ended the week at $68.29 per barrel, according to Plains All American. Natural gas prices on the NYMEX started the week with a 7.5-cent gain before declining the next 3 days. Prices added 6 cents Friday to end the week at $3.674 per MCF, down from $3.749 at Monday's close. It's very hard to predict what will happen short term, the next couple of months, but I still think they will soften long term when the 6 million barrels per day from OPEC Plus returns and 2 million barrels per day from Iran returns, David Bledsoe, president of Henry Resources, told the Reporter Telegram by email. Short term is so dependent on what OPEC Plus decides regarding the next 5 months, and since there is some disagreement, it has become harder to predict. Kyle Soak, Director, Corporate Finance and Investor Relations at PDC Energy, told the Reporter Telegram by email, "We don't expect any changes to our operating activity as a result of higher crude prices." PDC is currently operating 1 drilling rig and a part-time completion crew, each of which is expected to drill, complete 15 to 20 wells, respectively, for the full year 2021. The ranges and plan described above is representative of our 2022 plans as well. The Energy Information Administration has issued a more upbeat forecast for its July short-term energy outlook. In its outlook, the EIA forecasts West Texas Intermediate to average 71 cents a barrel in the third quarter, $6 higher than its June outlook. The EIA also expects WTI to average $68 in the fourth quarter, $7 higher than its June forecast. The EIA said this follows a similar path to Brent crude, the world standard. EIA predicts Brent will average $72 per barrel in the second half of the year, $73 in the third quarter and $71 in the fourth quarter, and $67 in 2022, both $6 higher than its June forecast. The agency also revised global oil production downward by 210,000 barrels a day, leading to larger inventory draws in the second half of the year and smaller forecast inventory builds next year. In its forecast, the agency said this downward revision contributed to the higher price expectations. The EIA also lowered its forecast of Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries production by 110,000 barrels a day in the second half of the year, the largest driver of downward revisions in production. For 2022, the EIA made minor revisions to U.S. and OPEC production forecasts, resulting in the global production forecast remaining at 101.8 million barrels a day in its July outlook. Bloomberg reported that not only are markets concerned with the rapidly spreading Delta variant of the virus, but the prospect of additional sullies from the OPEC Plus coalition as the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia work to resolve a disagreement that sidetracked the coalition's talks on supply levels earlier this month. Despite the week's decline, Bloomberg reported oil prices have surged about 13% over the last 3 months. Hello, this is Michael reading the Odessa American, published Saturday, July 17, 2021. Bond Committee convenes. For the first time since the pandemic hit, the Ector County ISD Bond Committee reviewed the committee charges, needs, and feedback from stakeholders. The previous incarnation was the Facilities Committee. Many of those who were on that committee returned to the bond group Thursday night at Buse Elementary School. The committee will deliberate and formulate a potential bond package to be brought to the ECISD Board of Trustees in December, and they will make a decision on proceeding or not from there. The bond committee will be meeting regularly in different locations, and issues will be broken out into subject areas, such as finance. Officials noted that career and technical education was top of mind for people, said Daryl Pearson, a partner with PBK Architects. PBK walked the district a few years ago to determine needs. The total identified last time was more than $700 million, Pearson says. Ideas such as 9th grade and 6th grade centers were reviewed, as was a central CTE facility. Adding another high school, staffing, and others were also discussed. Disproportionate discipline of minorities was another issue brought up by committee member Gene Collins. Lorraine Perryman, who is co-leading the committee with Chris Cole, said it's been an issue for decades, but nobody has talked about it. The last bond, which included three new elementary schools and additions to Odessa and Permian High School, was passed in 2012 and was $129 million. The vote was 63% for and 37% against. A tax ratification election passed in 2017 included salary increases, controlled access, and secured fencing on campuses, bus leasing and purchases, and roofing projects. District-funded projects included fencing, sidewalks, wayfinding signs, roof repairs and replacements, HVAC equipment replacement, flooring repair, restoration and replacement, parking and paving improvements, interior painting, LED retrofits, asbestos abatement, new playground equipment, new CTE welding labs, a new transitional learning facility for special education, athletic facility improvements, new portable classroom buildings, and more. Courtney Smith, executive director of operations, said there were 165 portables in the district. Superintendent Scott Murray said it is more expensive to educate children in portables in part because of utilities. Murray went over the district's mission and goals, obtaining devices for every student and working toward providing broadband for all families in the county. Some of this was funded by CARES money, with the city and county providing a share, Murray said. He noted that the district is working toward hiring more teachers, paying them more, growing its own teachers, and doing more with fewer adults, but the same number of students. Perryman said everything discussed in the meetings will be on the district website. Creative Arts. The 2021 Permian Basin Fair and Expo is seeking creative art entries. The Creative Arts Committee announced Out of Africa as the 2021 theme after having to cancel the 2020 Fair and Expo due to the pandemic. The Creative Arts competition is one of the largest of its kind held in the Permian Basin. Treasures of different talents and skills are displayed every year during fair days. 2021 entries will reflect or depict any item, being, or thing representing an out-of-Africa motif. All divisions of creative arts will be included in this competition. Winners will be selected from each division and will receive special awards. Entries will be accepted from noon to 8 p.m. August 29th through the 31st. Each year, fairgoers make their way through Building G on the Ector County Fairgrounds, where the entries are displayed. Exhibits featuring sewing, quilts, paintings, culinary, collections, crafts, and much more can be seen during the fair's run. Live demonstrations bring the talents to life as veterans to novice share their creativity. This year, many different featured artists are scheduled to be part of the creative arts presentation, including Sandra Houston, Cindy Falconberry, Cat Niece, Comanche Trail Wood Turners, Permian Basin Steampunk, Permian Basin Model Airplane Club, Bruce Weeks, and Artisan Art Walk. For a full list of general rules and regulations, visit pbfair.com. The Permian Basin Fair and Expo is set to run from September 3rd to the 12th. Education Advocates Unite. The premise that education is the baseline for growth and success, and every child deserves the best education available, regardless of their locale and socioeconomic situation, as the basis for the creation of two separate education-focused organizations set up by community members in Midland and Odessa. Educate Midland was organized in 2015 with the sole purpose of supporting and enhancing the offerings of Midland Independent School District. 1 year later, Odessa community leaders organized the Education Partnership of the Permian Basin, aimed at improving the overall education offerings in the region, with Odessa public, private, charter, and the higher education systems as their main focus area. Both organizations set their sights on the overall improvement of education, yet with differing areas of focus, a news release stated. Those organizations will announce their unification at a 10 a.m. news conference at the Region 18 Education Service Center conference room at 2811 La Force Boulevard near the Midland International Airport. At that time, the executive boards of Educate Midland and the Education Partnership of the Permian Basin will officially announce the unification of those two organizations. These leaders will encompass this regional approach by having representation of leadership from Midland, Odessa, and soon-to-be-added area communities to encompass the regional outreach. The group has adopted the Education Partnership's ongoing mission, creating a community where kids love to learn, teachers love to teach, and people love to live, while striving to be the highest performing educational region in the state of Texas. With this goal in mind, it is the unified group's belief that these aims can only be achieved with the two largest communities in our region working together to lead this important change. When our organization formed more than 5 years ago, we aspired to grow into a regional effort. The timing is right to partner with our like-minded neighbors in taking this next step to focus on all students in our area, Lorraine Perryman, Education Partnership Board Chair, said in the release. Other board members include Colin Sewell, Pat Cantry, and Renee Earls. Educate Midland Board President Carmen Hendricks Bryant echoes Perryman's thoughts as she has led her organization through this six-month research and deliberation phase. We're excited to align and bring a true region-wide approach to collective impact in the Permian Basin, Hendricks Bryant said. Other Educate Midland executive committee members include Lori Boldrick, Christine Foreman, and Brian Stubbs. This united entity will help improve educational outcomes in our region, cradle to career. Based on this new configuration, Adrian Vega will continue to serve as the executive director of the EPPB, with the addition of Mike Mills and Becca Myers of EM as team members. The staffs of the organizations have already been working together on several projects, including the power bags benefiting newborns in both communities, as well as the Grow Our Own Network program, which focuses on strengthening educational pathways and experiences for students that are parallel to the workforce needs of our Permian Basin businesses. MMH awarded Level 3 maternal designation. Midland Memorial Hospital has been designated as a Level 3 maternal facility by the Texas Department of State Health Services, DSHS. The Level 3 designation is awarded to hospitals that provide comprehensive care for complex medical, surgical, and obstetrical conditions for pregnant and postpartum patients. This designation is a testament to our community that we have the expertise to provide quality and compassionate care to every mother and baby that comes in our doors. Tanya Burtonshaw, MSN, RNC, MNN, Director of Women's and Children's Services, says, "I'm incredibly proud of our team for this accomplishment and commitment to the highest level of care right here in Midland." Melissa Weems, MSN, RNC, and L&D Clinical Manager, says, "To earn Level 3 designation, facilities must demonstrate their ability to provide care for pregnant and postpartum patients with low-risk conditions to significant complex medical, surgical, and/or obstetrical conditions that present a high risk of maternal morbidity or mortality. Ensure access to consultation to a full range of medical and maternal subspecialists and surgical specialists and behavioral health specialists. Ensure capability to perform major surgery on site. Have physicians with critical care training available at all times to actively collaborate with maternal fetal medicine physicians and/or obstetrics and gynecology. Physicians with obstetrics training and privileges in maternal care. Have skilled personnel with documented training, competencies, and annual continuing education specific for the population served. Facilitate transports and provide outreach education to lower-level designated facilities, including the quality assessments and performance improvement process." Odessa American Obituaries, published Saturday, July 17, 2021. Wanda Rose Henderson Johnson, Burleson. Graveside service for Wanda Rose Henderson Johnson, 93, of Burleson, formerly of Odessa, will be conducted at 11 a.m. Monday, July 19th, in the Coleman City Cemetery in Coleman, Texas. Wanda Rose Henderson Johnson passed away July 15th in Burleson at a retirement center. Wanda was born in Coleman County to Markham and Rose Henderson on January 24, 1928. Wanda was preceded in death by her husband on March 2004. Parents Markham and Rose Seals Henderson, sister Crystal Ruth Whitney, brothers Hilburn, Clay, Roy, Dale, Ray, Fred, and Kenneth. Wanda is survived by two children, Denise and husband Gordon Peppard of Burleson, Tommy Ray Johnson of Gordonville, plus two granddaughters and four great-grandchildren. Death notices from Saturday. Odos Alvin Odie Capps III, Midland. Odos Alvin Odie Capps III, 53, died Sunday, July 11th in Midland. Services are pending with American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory of Midland. Blanca Isela Zavala Dominguez, Odessa. Blanca Isela Zavala Dominguez, 52, died Thursday, July 15th in Odessa. Services are pending with Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa.
Odessa American, Sunday, July 18th, 2021. Officials, Stop Dumping Pets, by Michael Bauer. The Humane Society of Odessa has seen a rise in the number of dogs that have been dumped illegally, and the staff is pleading with the community to stop. Dumping animals is both illegal and also dangerous to the pets. Shelter Director Heather Sylvia says this is a problem that's been going on for years, where people will dump their pets or strays that they find, but said that recently it has gotten worse, where people have thrown dogs over the fence at the shelter. "It's been going on for years," Sylvia said. "We have an overpopulation issue here. People still backyard breed and giving away on the side of the road and dumping them on the side of the road. If they can't find them a home, they will dump them. A lot of times they dump them over here with us. If we don't know that they're here, that's potentially dangerous for them, especially with the heat. We're seeing a rise in that." Sylvia said their efforts to beg people not to illegally dump their pets are limited. Getting the word out has been a challenge. "There's not a whole lot that we can do except reach out to the media and try to educate people that there are other ways," Sylvia said. "You don't have to dump your pet." "If for some reason people can't keep their pets," Sylvia said, "there are better ways than to dump them. There are many rescues in this town," Sylvia said. "They are willing to help. You just have to give them some time to find a spot for your pet. Dumping them is not the answer." "Another reason why dumping pets is bad is because it hurts the shelter. Our vet bills are sky high, and we're having to foot the bill for these animals because nobody else is going to do it," Sylvia said. "Animals dumped on us, we're not going to turn our heads. We're going to take them in. They need to see a vet, we'll take them to a vet and see what they need. Our vet bills are crazy high, and we need the community to help us. We're needing donations." Office manager Christina Taylor, who's been working at the shelter for almost 5 years, says this has been a problem since she's been working at the Humane Society, and said that this year has gotten worse. "We've seen an increase in animals in general," Taylor said. "I'm here the entire workday, and I see the amount of people who call or come in, and on average we get about 50 people between coming in and walking in that try to bring in and dump dogs, and about 30 people for cats. That's every day of the week." Not only has it been a problem for the Humane Society of Odessa, but it's been a problem throughout this part of the state. "It is a huge West Texas problem," Sylvia said. "I'm sure there are other areas that have this issue, but it is really bad here, and the virus has made things worse, because the amount of animals on the street is higher. People need to be educated and vaccinate their pets, and keep up with those vaccinations as well." Sylvia said that the Humane Society of Odessa is usually at maximum capacity, which makes things even more challenging. "As soon as one gets adopted, somebody dumps another," Sylvia said. "It's never ending." In the last week, Sylvia estimates that over 20 animals have been dumped at the shelter. "Some of them are litters," Sylvia said. "That's like 6 right there, and that adds up really quickly when they're dumping litters of puppies. Part of the reason has been due to the pandemic. There's been a lot of people lose their jobs or move," Sylvia said. "The pets that they adopted, they can't take them a lot of time, so they just leave them or dump them and leave town. That leaves us to pick up and help them. It's sad." One way to combat the problem has been to educate people to know what they're getting themselves into when they rescue a pet. "When you adopt a pet, it's like adopting a child," Taylor said. Taylor says she'll talk to those who are adopting a pet and explain to them that it's a long-term commitment. "If you think you're not in the best living situation or that you might be going through something, maybe now is not the best time," Taylor said. "If you do not think that this is something that's going to be at least 10 years in the works for you, then you should wait and sleep on it. This is especially true for first-time pet owners. People who have never owned a pet, I would highly suggest dog-sitting for a friend for a couple of days or even coming over here and volunteering for a few days," Taylor said. "Just try to do a little bit of research. There are a lot of responsibilities. First-time pet owners, if they're responsible, and if they want to be responsible, they should do a little bit of research and ask a lot of questions. That makes me feel better." People can donate to the Humane Society of Odessa at https://tinyurl.com/4D4Z62RS and click donate. "We're needing money to help pay our vet bills and get those down," Sylvia said. "They're sky high because we have animals that are here every single day. 95% of them have something wrong. They either have a broke leg or they have parvo, and it's sad. We're not going to let them suffer, so we're going to take them to the vet. The vet bills keep rising, and we don't have donations coming in. We need the community to help us with donations so we can get our vet bills paid and save more animals." "When you adopt a pet, it's like adopting a child." Christina Taylor, Humane Society of Odessa Office Manager.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Odessa American for Monday, July 19th. Law firm hosting back-to-school event. The story was written by Michael Bauer. After last year's backpack giveaway was scaled down due to the pandemic, this year's annual event, which is put on by the Fadul, Clough, Hardy & Conaway Law Firm, will be held in less restricted settings. FCHC will be hosting its second annual backpack giveaway, which will take place at 10 a.m. August 7th at 1931 East 37th Street in Suite 1 and 2 in the parking lot. FCHC will be giving away 500 backpacks. Each child will be able to build their own backpack with school supplies provided by the law firm. The event is free to the community and is on a first-come, first-served basis. Case manager and marketing coordinator at FCHC, Crystal Miller, said that last year's inaugural event was only in a drive-through setting due to restrictions from COVID, and they only gave away 400 backpacks. Quote, "We had them drive through and gave them some masks and hand sanitizers," Miller said of last year's event. "It was a good turnout, but it wasn't as big as we wanted it to be because everyone had to stay in their cars," end quote. With restrictions being lifted this year and some things getting back to normal, Miller said it was a better idea to have kids fill their own backpacks with supplies that will be provided. Quote, "It's still a backpack giveaway. However, this year we're calling it Build a Backpack," Miller said. "We're actually letting the kids build their own backpacks. Our vision is that we're letting the kids show up, get out of their vehicles, and pick a backpack. We have 14 different designs of backpacks, ranging from Disney characters up to clear and mesh. They're going to pick their backpacks out, and we're going to have bins of school supplies that have been provided by the FCHC. They'll get to pick their own crowns and own markers and their map colors," end quote. The event will also include curbside bistro that will grill hot dogs, and Kona Ice will be handing out snow cones. Quote, "When they're done building their own backpacks, they get a bracelet that will allow them to get their own hot dog and snow cone," Miller said. "We will have curbside bistro that'll be participating, and Kona Ice will be giving out the snow cone," end quote. B93 will be out playing music as well, and there will be a drawing for a Dallas Cowboys preseason game. Quote, "We also got the okay to do a giveaway for the first 100 people, and we'll be giving out Cowboys tickets," Miller said. "The first 100 people will get their names in the drawing for a Cowboys preseason game," end quote. Miller says that FCHC hopes to stress how important the community is to them by putting on this year's backpack giveaway. Quote, "With our law firm, we care about the community and anything we can do to help, specifically with kids in need," Miller said. "We hope people appreciate what we're doing and hope that people can show up and bring their kids," end quote. An attorney at FCHC, Manuel Hernandez, says they wanted to help out more this year with the COVID restrictions lifted. Quote, "Last year was different for everybody, and putting on events was no different," Hernandez said. "We felt like we needed to try to do more to provide some direct help and relief for the community. Building off of that this year, with fewer restrictions, we figured what better way to help some more people and give them something to do. Not only give them a place to pick up a backpack, but to pick up some snow cones and make a day of it," end quote. Hernandez also praised the other businesses in the community, including Curbside Bistro, B93, and Kona Ice, for helping out. Quote, "We're happy and excited to have partners in the community," Hernandez said. "We've been excited and blessed to help with events like with Chef Alejandro Barrientos at Curbside Bistro, like when he has his Thanksgiving meal. He's returning the favor, and helping us out in our efforts. It feels good to be embraced by the community," end quote. RSV showing up early this year. The story was written by Carol A. Cates, Chief Nursing Officer, Odessa Regional Medical Center. COVID is on the rise again. The Delta variant is in our community, and it is living up to its promise. It spreads more easily than the original COVID strain, and unvaccinated people are getting very sick. The hospitals are starting to go down the path of stretched again when it comes to beds and caregivers for COVID patients. Please, if you haven't gotten vaccinated, consider doing so. Unfortunately, COVID is not the only respiratory illness on the rise right now. One of the few positive things that happened because of all the COVID precautions, social distancing, masking, and frequent hand washing, is we didn't see much of the other seasonal respiratory illnesses last winter, like flu and respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV. Flu can be serious for all ages, and RSV can as well, though it tends to be the most serious for small children and adults with weak immune systems. RSV can occur in adults who don't have weak immune systems, but it rarely results in severe illness. As we have eased the COVID precautions, unfortunately, RSV seems to be rearing its ugly head. And it's also unexpected. RSV is traditionally a seasonal illness in the late fall and winter months. Experts feel the surge is happening because we suppressed its normal circulation time in the winter with the COVID precautions, so it is making up for lost time now. RSV can be very serious, especially for kids under 5. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, RSV causes about 57,000 hospitalizations, 500,000 ER visits, and 1.5 million doctor's office visits each year. Between 100 and 500 kids under 5 every year die related to RSV. RSV is so common in small children, most kids will have had the illness before their second birthday. An estimated 177,000 adults have RSV each year. However, the experts feel this number is likely low because RSV testing in adults is uncommon. RSV becomes symptomatic 4 to 6 days after exposure. Kids at the most risk for severe illness are premature infants, infants less than 6 months of age, kids younger than 2 with chronic lung or heart problems, kids with weak immune systems, and kids with neuromuscular problems, especially those kids who have trouble swallowing or clearing mucus secretions. Symptoms of RSV include runny nose, decreased appetite, coughing, sneezing, fever, and wheezing. In infants, symptoms can be irritability, decreased activity, and breathing difficulties. A big part of the reason RSV is so hard on the littlest kids and those at high risk is they either have small or difficult to clear airways in their lungs. The airways have several different names because of their size: the trachea, the bronchi, and the bronchioles. If you think of your lungs like a tree, the airways are the trunk and all the branches. They get smaller and smaller and keep branching out until they get to the leaves. In the case of airways, unlike trees, the trunk and branches are all hollow tubes. In the lungs, alveoli are like the leaves. They are at the end of each airway branch. Alveoli are tiny round sacs that fill with air when we breathe. The exchange of oxygen and carbon dioxide with the blood happens in the alveoli. When airways are small, they are easier to block with mucus and air can't get down to the alveoli. When people have difficulty removing mucus from their lungs, it blocks the airways and again, air can't get to the alveoli. Treatment for RSV centers around getting that mucus out of the airways through a combination of drugs and mechanical treatments like vibration and percussion, as well as oxygen therapy, so the air that gets to the alveoli has more oxygen available to enter the blood. Not surprisingly, the things that prevent COVID also prevent RSV. Frequent hand washing, keeping hands away from the face, avoiding close contact with sick people, covering coughs and sneezes, cleaning and disinfecting surfaces, and staying home when you are sick. Those are good practices all the time, not just when we live in a pandemic.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.